You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds bringing you your murder mystery world tour. It's time to step off the boat, step off the plane. We are on our second stop for 2020, Herds. Welcome to New Zealand.
I'm surprised you didn't say step off the train, but I guess it'd be kind of difficult to get to New Zealand.
It would be a bit difficult to get
via
there.
Via train.
Yes.
But you're right. Maybe our boat train will be here. We'll get those next year. Anyway, it's time for Money in the Morgue, Flex. That is the novel that I'm challenging you to solve.
Yes.
In part one today of our discussion on the novel. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, by Naomi Marsh, who is one of the four queens of crime. This is, of course, by Naomi Marsh, who is one of the four queens of crime, which, of course, how we're tying into Agatha Christie, because them queens of crime don't quit. But this novel is a little bit different.
Yes.
It is the 33rd of the Inspector Allen mysteries written by Naomi Marsh. But this particular novel was begun during World War II, abandoned, and then picked up after her death by Stella Duffy. Originally, there were only three chapters and some kind of general notes on how the plot would progress and how the mystery would be played out, that sort of thing. And Stella Duffy had taken up the challenge of publishing this in 2018, the fully realized 33rd and probably final mystery for Allen to kind of solve.
Yes. And it's now 37 chapters. It's
true. It's quite long. So congratulations to Stella Duffy. I appreciate the work you've gone into to make this little masterpiece happen.
37 chapters, though, is probably not the longest book we've covered on the show, even by a stretch, because they are relatively short chapters.
I was going to say.
Relatively well packaged.
Yeah. They don't seem to drag so much. Although I will say, when I first read this novel, the opening chapters, the opening kind of, I would say, first act, the first third, I think drags a little bit.
Well, that first third we're talking about is chapters 1 to 11.
Yes, 1 to 11 out of 37. Because there's a very lovely stopping point where the character that we're following literally says, this would be a very good spot for Act 1 to end.
Yep.
So obviously that's where we're ending for our first episode.
I suppose talking of Act 1, it's worth bringing up that this is a very stage-minded book.
Yes. This novel is focused on the dramatis personae, which I've mentioned a couple of times on this show, but the dramatis personae, it's a theater term, really just referring to the list of characters that are going to be in the play or in the story. And in my mind, this is specifically referring to, you know, the major characters and their relationships with each other. This is what you're really focusing on, the dramatic persons in the story. Mm-hmm. And we're given a nice little list at the start of the novel too.
I suppose we should introduce Detective Allen.
Sure, if you like to.
Inspector Roderick Allen is actually a UK-based detective in most of Marsh's books. I think there's two or three, including this one, where he's actually in New Zealand, which is Marsh's home country.
Of course.
But basically, the setup for this novel is that he has been sent here on an undercover mission regarding some suspicious radio signals and has found himself at a military base that those radio signals seem to have pointed to when all of a sudden an old man dies and the matron of the hospital that he's staying at seems to be found dead as well.
And all of the money is missing.
Yes.
Mr. Glossop is one of the, I would say, the most important character in this novel.
Definitely.
He is the driver who is to take the money from the hospital that they're at right now to other hospitals that need to have their you know, pay brought in. And he's been stuck at this hospital for quite some time because of a bum van. The tires is flat, and it's very dangerous trying to travel through New Zealand with a tire that does not work properly. He's been complaining about this for quite some time, which is why he's the most fantastic character, because all he does is complain, and it's wonderful.
It is great.
But yeah, so the money that he has been charged with safeguarding disappears right under his nose, out from the safe in the matron's office. And the matron is, of course, found deceased
in a body bag that was allegedly meant to be for the old man who died.
Yes.
Who was definitely not murdered.
Interesting. Interesting thought.
The matron, dubious. The old man, definitely murdered.
Oh, interesting. Well, we'll get into that more in the second
part,
I suppose, for the theories there.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know. I find it very interesting, as I was saying, that we spend so much time setting up characters who are not the detective. This makes sense, of course, because it's the 33rd in the series.
Yes.
Maybe you're familiar with Allen, but I think, especially for a murder mission of like this, the fact that Naomi Marsh spent so much time ironing out the specific relationships within mm-hmm. all of the characters, I find that very commendable. I really enjoy that, you know?
It's particularly strange if you look at the first three chapters and how that sets up what's going on as opposed to the later chapters. A lot of the reviews that I've read of this book, which were all vetted for spoilers, don't worry.
don't worry about it. I got you.
All were very divided on whether Stella Duffy bridged the gap between her own writing and Niall Marsh's effectively. Mm. And I'll spoil it for you now, Herds. We are, in fact, going to be visiting Niall Marsh proper as our next book to actually get that comparison down.
Excellent, excellent.
And I'll tell you more about that over the coming weeks. But I think regardless of whether you think the styles were bridged effectively, the story as a whole flows very consistently.
Yeah. Speaking as the veteran here of the episode, I think that definitely by the end of the story, even though some elements of Fair Play may not line up, you know what? Who knows, Flex? Maybe you'll blow me away and get everything 100% right. But I think that the story itself, flowing from the first three chapters all the way to the end, I kind of loved it. Alan as an inspector is fantastic, though. We'll talk more about that as we get to see more of him, obviously. But I think that the actual flow of the story from one event to the next is performed almost seamlessly. I really appreciate sort of his talent in that regard as a writer.
Yeah, I think the only gripe that I really have with the writing of this story is that there's a lot of times that phrases feel repeated. Mm. And I don't want to say that that's a bad thing about the book, because part of me suspects that may be a clue that comes back later down along the line, particularly when, you know, we get to a lot of the references to, you know, Shakespearean works and a lot of characters using the same turn of phrase as the same reaction. Sure. And part of me thinks that, like, because I think there's a little bit of a conspiracy going on here, but I'm not too sure about it.
Maybe.
That maybe there's like some code phrases in there that I'm meant to be following, and that's why things are repeated. But there's also some characters that I don't think would make sense to use them.
Maybe.
But as far as details go, that is extraordinarily nitpicky. And the one thing I did enjoy is that even though it takes until effectively chapter 10 to actually find the crime,
yeah,
like we've still gotten a lot done. We've had a lot of suspicious things happen. We've had a lot of interactions that I think are very, very easy hooks for how things are going to tie together later down the line.
Yeah, I definitely think you can take a very, I mean, obviously I've set this up, but
yeah,
you can take a very good crack at figuring out, you know, who among the Domatus personae is guilty or innocent based on the various interactions that we see. One of the ones that's most vivid in my mind is Rosamund coming up upon Maurice Sanders, I believe it is. And there is history there. They were like together, but now they're not together. And she's like all high and up about it. And she's got her winnings from the races. And there's like there's a lot of detail packed into a simple like, oh, I was, you know, walking along and I saw these idiots, you know, who were supposed to be lying in bed, but they're running around outside the hospital compound. And it should be mentioned, of course, that beyond the character dynamics and coming to understand what every person kind of wants and desires, another element that's really kind of important is the environment.
We do the classic, we're trapped here by a storm.
Exactly. That's exactly the thing, right? Like, it is at once a very traditional murder mystery with the storm and like the bridge has been blown out and all this other stuff. And we can't get a hold of anyone. What do we do? You know, but it also feels very palatable with the way that Stella Duffy actually writes the story. I'm looking forward to this one, Flex. I'm looking forward to see if you can solve this mystery.
I will tell you right now, if I'm solving it, it's not going to be today.
Okay. Fair enough. You know
it's
what?
It's just not happening.
I ain't gonna fight you, but I think you got a good crack at it.
The body was only revealed to us moments ago.
I know, but there's been so much lead up to this moment.
I'm telling you, Herds, we're gonna come back in the next part or part three, depending on how successful I find myself. Mm-hmm. And it's either going to be that this episode is all about just rubbish nonsense character diatribe that ends up having a couple of mild things that hook in, or just the entire crime can be solved in the first part with like one extra clue that's in part two.
Yep.
And I'm just missing it entirely.
That's right.
And I'm so excited to find that out.
Look, I'd let you know, normal rules apply. If you can figure out the who, the how, and the why done it, you get your point. If you are able to pin down exactly what is going on here, I'll leave you a little bit of leeway. If you're able to pin down exactly who every character or characters that are involved, I will give you another point. That is on the table right now.
Herds, I do have to ask you. I've offered you 2 points for last week. You've offered me 2 points for this week. Do we just want to make this year double or nothing?
You know what? I'm in.
Okay.
I'm down for it. Double or nothing.
Double or nothing.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We'll be back in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. And Herds, here on your Murder Mystery World Tour, I wanted to try something new today.
Oh, I love new things.
New
days.
It is 2020.
New Year's.
It is our second book of the year. And I wanted to try bring some news to the table.
Yeah.
We've had a few questions over on social media, at Flex and Herds, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, about how we can keep up with the crime fiction world when, we're typically covering a lot of older stuff, a lot of golden age stuff, you know, Money in the Mortgage we're covering today is the most recent thing we've covered. So I thought it was an appropriate time to bring in the modern world of crime fiction to the show and talk a bit about how I keep up with it and, you know, how to keep on top of it.
The answer is with too much effort. And so that's why we're doing this segment.
Yeah, I think particularly with films like Knives Out and, Kenneth Branagh's Poirot adaptations, there's obviously a little bit of a resurgence in interest in the Golden Age murder mystery.
I would say so.
And I think that it's really good to look at modern reinterpretations of that. Money in the Morgue is a fantastic example so far, and I'm excited to get further into that. I also think, Knives Out was fantastic. Murder on the Orient Express by Kenneth Branagh was not stellar, but it was entertaining.
We'll have to watch that at some point.
Well, we will be challenging Sean Britton. To Death on the Nile later this year when the subsequent Poirot adaptation by Kenneth Branagh comes out. But I think the one that is coming up the soonest that I wanted to talk about, at least in the film sphere, is Franny Fisher's Miss Fisher and the Crypt of Tears. Now, Herds, I don't know if you're familiar with Franny Fisher, but Franny Fisher is...
Vaguely.
Femme Fatale Sherlock Holmes in Australia.
Yes, I know that she carries a golden gun, which seems like not a good idea if you're, a detective trying to blend in or like seduce your target or whatever. Like, look, I'm just saying guns is good because a lady got to keep herself safe, but a golden gun, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. My family is big into Miss Fisher's murder mysteries.
Really?
The only version of Clue or Cluedo that we are allowed to play is Miss Fisher's Cluedo. And I think the show is fantastic fun, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it on the big screen with that upcoming adaptation, which we'll be covering after our next novel. I think it comes out 2 weeks, the 27th of February.
Apparently it's set in the exotic land of the Arabian deserts. She's finding treasure or something.
I think from the shorts it does a little bit of traveling, so I'm looking forward to getting that movie on the show.
A little bit of globetrotting.
The other thing that I've really been enjoying, jumping away from the movie sphere, obviously those films are coming out later this year, and we'll always have information up on social media when we're talking about those. But I've been really impressed recently, actually, with The Guardian. International publication has been putting out a good bit of crime fiction stories on its website.
I have seen a little bit of this.
Yeah.
I know that they're putting up some very intriguing reviews. Might be a strong word, but impressions of some of the excellent murder mystery novels that are coming out. The one that has most intrigued me, I haven't had a chance to read it, but The Lammases by Declan Burke has perhaps the most unique cover of a book that I have seen in a long time. It's just various like glasses and bottles and
things.
Are
you judging a book by its cover right
yes,
now?
Yes, I am.
Here on Death
because,
of the Reader?
Because so many of them are the same thing. They look all the same. But this one is like a series of like wine glasses and bottles and things. Mm-hmm. And I could not tell you what The Lammas is about. But apparently it has a very metafictional context or tone.
Interesting.
Insane. I want to read that. We're doing that on the show. I'm telling you, that's a promise.
All right. I think the other thing that has been very interesting up on The Guardian was a piece by Francesca Wade about the Detection Club. Mm. Obviously, we're big fans of the Detection Club around here, even though The Floating Admiral is an awful book that you should absolutely read.
You should never
absolutely
read it. Terrible
read
idea.
It.
Yeah, for sure.
So we'll have links up on the podcast for that. And shout out, as always, to Ronald Knox, who everyone seems to write about, but no one seems to have read. Like, the more articles I read on the man, the more sad I feel, because it's like, oh, everyone just knows the rules.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. Ronald Knox is quoted much more often than anybody kind of understands what his works were about and how like flippant they were, how silly they were.
He's very much a historical oddity, as we discussed in our very first episode on the show when we talked about the three taps.
Yes, which is good to revisit.
Yes. You know, particularly when we look at, you know, his broadcast that terrified London listeners, that was kind of a spiritual predecessor to War of the Worlds, or, you know, his rule set. But if you actually go and look at some of the things he read, he was a... he was an expert on how people read books, I think.
Yeah.
And we talk about that in our episode. But the other thing that I've found since then was a fascinating discourse between Ronald Knox and, I believe, C.S. Lewis, which was actually separate from crime fiction. I believe it was a religion discussion, but I got absolutely hooked into that when we were when we'd finished The Three Taps last year. And there's definitely some interesting things if you kind of dig a bit further into Ronald Knox. So always shout out to our hero, our Lord and Savior. Mm. Is that blasphemy to call Father Ronald Knox our Lord and Savior?
Here's the thing. I don't think that Knox would mind. I think he's such a good-tempered individual.
With a great sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd also like to shout out the Mystery Tribune. There's a fantastic article I found on there recently about Scott Oldenburg's love of locked room mysteries. The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr as an example that he uses there. And it's a really fantastic exploration of the importance of locked room mysteries, including Murder on the Orient Express and Then There Were None.
Excellent, excellent stories.
I think in terms of books that I'm actually looking forward to at the moment, Andrea Camilleri's Inspector Montalbano's series is continuing with its 25th novel. The 24th came out just towards the end of last year, and we're already getting another one in April this year, and I'm very excited. I really, really love kind of the charm of these. It's been adapted for a BBC series, I believe, that I haven't actually caught yet, but there's a very quaint charm to it. I mean, even if you, here we go, looking at covers again, just look at some of the covers of these books. The upcoming book, The Safety Net, has this wonderful like film set showing on the front cover that has me very excited for what kind of filmmaking antics we're going to get into in the series.
It's one of those funny things, isn't it? You can never judge a book by its cover, but...
but it's marketing, right?
But
it's part of the appeal.
The only thing that you've seen of the book, when you see, you know, five books that have, you know, a picture of some landscape and it's, you know, dark color with the text in front, light colored, like usually like a sun rising or a skyline, and then a dark color down the bottom where you put like by this author or starring this or whatever.
I believe like, the premise for the new Andrea Camilleri novel is something along the lines of a Swedish television show is in town making it.
Sounds great.
I'm very excited to see what goofy gimmicks we can get into with a Swedish television show in Sicily.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit strange. I like it. Yeah, give me those weird, wacky stories.
And while we're on the topic of covers, actually, I did want to talk about, you know, the thumbnails that we use for episodes on YouTube and up on the podcast. It's always so difficult to pick, particularly with old novels, between the enormous variety of covers they've had.
I remember Caves of Steel had about, I want to say, 20 different covers for that novel, depending on what like time period it was re-released in.
And so many of them made absolutely no sense if you actually read the book.
It was so good.
It was clearly just like a generic sci-fi art that had been commissioned kind of analogous to the book.
No, it was great. I mean, that leads into the themes or the visual imagery of that book where it was always very vaguely described.
Yes, absolutely.
It was always very evocative, but you were never sure quite what of.
Yes.
Excellent.
That is a fantastic way to put that. Before we close out today's segment, you know, we'll bring this back with perhaps some more specific information as we kind of get into the grind of more regular news now that we've introduced this.
Sure.
But we hope that this has given you kind of a palette to look at if you're interested in finding more about the murder mystery world. If you're interested in more up-to-date book coverage rather than the golden age nonsense that we're doing and some of the news we're bringing,
let us know. Honestly, like, if you're enjoying this segment, if you want to hear more news about what's going on in the world of Murder Mystery. It's like up to date and current. Let us know at Flex Nerds.
Yes.
Your feedback matters.
We also have our good friend Andrew Popel bringing you Final Draft every week here on 2SER.
Mm-hmm.
The episode originally airs every Saturday and then is replayed, I believe, on Wednesday morning and evening.
Yes.
So there's always some fantastic book coverage around here on 2SER. Keep an eye out for it. We are going to jump back over to Money in the Morgue.
Yes.
By Stella Duffy and Nio Marsh. That's the news. The crime fiction. We need a name for this segment.
We'll have to work.
We'll have to work.
I don't know what that is. The news you can use. That's a tagline. That's not a title. That's a tagline.
It needs a bit more death in it.
The cutting through the fat.
I feel like something like Cutting Edge is probably taken.
Yeah, like that's the problem. You got to find something like
we'll work on compelling. This. We should just jump back to the book, I think.
All right, get back to it. Get back to that Money in the Morgue.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour. This week on the show, we are talking part one, chapters 1 to 11 of Nio Marsh and Stella Duffy's Money in the Morgue. It is me on the new fresh meat end this time around, and I have got to solve a murder that happened literal seconds ago.
Good luck.
I'm scared, Hertz.
I'll let you know, I was just reading through the Dramatis Personae. There are 16 characters named. Now, that includes the matron and an old Mr. Brown,
uh-huh,
and the inspector, of course.
And but the grunts.
That includes the grunts.
Yes.
It includes everybody. But that still leaves you with a good 13 potential suspects to sort through.
I'm very excited. I will tell you right out the gate, Herds. I do not think I can do this week.
What?
I think that there is a bit of information that I'm missing here. Roderick Allen is in the country because of supposedly Japanese mini-subs sending supposed coordinates about this supposed hospital in supposedly New Zealand with supposedly a bunch of veteran soldiers. And part of me wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that Roderick Allen has shown up in the wrong country, surrounded by a bunch of actors, and that's why we keep talking acting.
Are you telling me he's actually in a simulation orchestrated by the commies to get information out of him?
I feel like simulation.
Is that where this is going?
Simulation is a bit much for the 1930s and 40s.
It doesn't need to be a technical simulation. It could be just one of those towns they like to bomb with nuclear bombs.
That's what
simulation.
I'm saying. Yeah. I'm just making sure that we are using simulation in a term that people understand, because
yes,
we so often associate it with the virtual realities days.
Not a virtual simulation, just a regular simulation.
A bunch of actors around here all acting strange. Listen, I want to know why he's been sent out here all by himself without his, dear Inspector Fox.
Mm.
He's writing letters back to Fox. He's writing letters back to Troy.
Yeah.
So far, he hasn't received any correspondence. I think that this could all just be a big ruse, Herds.
No, how could it be a ruse? We can't do that twice in a row. That doesn't work. Look, it's because he's in deep cover. He cannot allow the people at the hospital to know that, those New Zealanders can't trust him. That's what he's operating off of. Only the British men.
Uh-huh.
Those are the only people that Alan could trust.
All right. Well,
that's how it'd be.
In that case, Hertz, if we're going to pretend that this isn't just a simulation laid out by the Axis powers to disable the great Roderick Allen, I think that I have no clue what's going on.
Oh, really?
Because
fascinating.
Clearly Sidney Brown has murdered his grandfather.
Okay, cool.
There is no contention in my mind.
Why do you believe that, sir? Why do you believe?
We'll get to that, Hertz.
Okay, so you hold on. So you're saying, I have no idea what's going on, hoop-a-doop-a-doop, but I think this, but why? I won't tell you.
That's the problem, is
what?
I know what's happened, but I have no idea why.
That's ridiculous.
Because let's look at this. We've got Sidney Brown.
Okay, sure.
Who is put in for 45 minutes with his grandfather, who he's never responded to comments of before, on the night that supposedly something suspicious is going to happen, and the night that Roderick Allen is supposedly supposed to be there, walks out after his grandfather has died, conveniently within the first 45 minutes of him showing up, despite him being sick for weeks, and then he says, no, I can't be here.
Yeah.
Is that not the most suspicious line that man could have said in that moment?
Dude, sometimes fate just brings things around that
way. It is ludicrous to me, sir.
Why would he kill his grandfather?
That's ludicrous. That's what I'm so confused about.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like, obviously he doesn't have a very good relationship with his grandfather, but, if it was about the relationship with his grandfather, surely we would have seen into that room.
All right, fair enough, fair enough. So you think that the young Sidney has murdered his grandfather?
I know that the young Sidney has murdered his grandfather because he damn well just told me.
Well, I'm glad that you're suspicious of the young. That's very much going to be thematic of this novel here, I think.
Okay.
What about the soldiers? You don't think they're involved at all? They're pretty physically capable people.
No, they're just they're faceless.
Okay.
I would, even if that ends up being part of the solution, I'd feel a little cheated, honestly, if it was them, because they don't have any detail. You know, we have Sergeant Bix and everyone else is just VADs.
That's not true. Some of them, they're in relationships with their various ladies. Maurice Sanders has his thing with Rosamund.
And what are their names, Herds?
They're Maurice Sanders, Brayling,
uh-huh,
and Bob Possett.
Well done,
I don't remember Brayling's first name because I'm terrible at most naming things, but I remember their names.
We'll get back to them in a second.
Okay, fair enough.
Now, the other question that we have is the matron's body.
Mm-hmm.
Which I will note was described as cold body, not cold dead body, not cold murdered body, just cold body.
Fair enough.
And it's raining outside. She's probably just a bit.
But the doctor checked for a pulse. the doctor on the scene of the crime,
and
which is a standard trope of this genre, went in and said, you know, touched her on the neck, was like, nope, she's dead.
And this, Herds, is where we start to get into dangerous territory.
Are you telling me that the doctor is an accomplice?
We're getting in deep here, Herds.
Oh, no.
So first of all, let's just go back to Glossop, because I mentioned earlier he was probably an unreliable narrator
did,
or a little
which is
confused.
Insane.
He sees the vicar leaving the matron's office just before he discovers what has gone awry, which says to me that the vicar is probably the man that is responsible for the departure of that there money.
Mm-hmm.
With some accomplices, probably.
Okay.
Were they responsible directly for the application of what's gone on? I don't know.
Okay, interesting.
But we get back to the main issue, Herds, which is we have a bunch of soldiers who may or may not be accomplices. We have a bunch of matron who may or may not be dead.
Yep.
We have a bunch of money, which may or may not be missing.
We have Sergeant Bix, who is the best character.
We have Sergeant Bix, who is undoubtedly the best character. No argument there.
Yep.
And we have a morgue that only has one entrance and one exit, and the money is nowhere to be found.
It's true.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe money in this day and age was made of paper.
Okay.
And thus it would not make sense to leave it outside in the rain.
It's true.
Which means it must be locked away somewhere. Oh, I think that the matron is either an accomplice or was knocked out.
To get
her key to get access to the morgue.
Well, so that's what's interesting is that Mr. Glossop, he, according to his testimony during the storm that occurs, he comes, you know, outside of his little building there and he sees Sister Comfort on the porch, who you have neglected to mention this entire time, which I find highly suspicious. Are you covering for her?
Yes.
Then the vicar enters.
Yes.
The porter, Will Kelly, knocks at this is the matron's office. And then the doctor approaches and quickly moves away from the matron's office. And then the vicar and the matron leave. And then that's when Glossop takes the opportunity to enter and set up his cot and finds the money gone.
Now, noticeably, the matron's key is needed for the morgue.
Okay.
All of those characters are relatively suspicious.
Okay.
The door to the matron's office is left unlocked. The safe is left unlocked.
Yep.
I assume that the matron and or her key were taken at that point, along with what was the contents of the safe. We used to open the morgue. The reason the doctor rocked up there is probably because he's like, oh, it's about time for me to administer the sleepy drugs to make her seem dead.
Okay.
Goes up, realizes, oh no, I've missed my cue because it would be very acty, which, you know, a bit of a trope of this novel, to have someone miss a cue. So he rocks up to the door of that office, goes, oh goodness, they must be down at the morgue already, rushes down to the morgue.
Fair enough.
Just guesswork at this point.
No, it's okay. That's what we're here for. We're here for you to figure
it
out.
The doctor has either been bribed with the extra money that was taken from Farson.
Okay.
Or is an accomplice.
Okay.
The vicar is a ringleader, and Kelly is actually just drunk.
This is very interesting. I like that last detail there. I appreciate it. It's very interesting seeing which characters you kind of are more suspicious of than I would be. I actually found that Sarah Warren and Rosamund to be quite the interesting pair, because Mr. Glossop also notes that he hears someone shouting as though in an argument that we can't tell if it's from the records office or from the transport office, which is, of course, where those two characters are staged.
Yes.
You don't find that suspicious at all?
I find it incredibly suspicious. I just don't really, I don't have a strong feeling about what to go off here, because clearly this mystery is set up so that someone is going to be tied into the radio signals that Alan was brought here for.
Okay.
I firmly believe that I am on the right track with this.
Okay.
But I have no idea which way I'm facing.
So you've completely neglected the love that is in the air tonight.
No, that's my job.
I know it is, but still, come on. That's right. We'll have much more to talk about next week in regards to love in the air.
I will say off the cuff, just to make sure that it does not seem like I'm ignoring it entirely, maybe the reason Sanders is frosty to Farson now is because he's roped in this conspiracy.
Maybe.
But that's all I have to go off.
We'll have to find out.
That we will. Mm. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Next week on the show, Herds, we are covering what chapters?
We're covering chapters 12 to 23, a slightly larger chunk of the story, as we drive through the interrogation phase.
I'm scared, I'm confused, I'm concerned.
You'll be fine.
But I will solve this, Herds.
Good luck, Flex. I'll be very impressed if you can.
Okay, then. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds, and we will see you next week.
See you.